Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The Black Belt Barrister is a barrister who gives out free legal advice on his... God, it sounds like an advert so far, doesn't it? He gives out free legal advice on his very popular YouTube channel. Everything from how to avoid certain police traps while driving or going about your day to what's going on with the big celebrity court cases of the day, which is what we'll be focusing on a bit more today. He's a really fascinating guy who does explain the difference between a barrister and a solicitor for you non-Brits or non experts, lay people, but they are both types of lawyers. The barristers are the ones who wear the funny wigs and gowns that you see in those old-timey movies, as well as modern trials in the UK. Today, after some initial explanations and introductions, he'll be taking us through the latest in the Kevin Spacey allegations, because that's all gone a bit quiet and sort of pops up every now and then. What's going on there? What did he do, that actor, that famous actor? And explaining as well what happened with Bill Cosby, because that also sort of fell away, and I believe he's out now. So he'll discuss body language and the latest updates with Amber Heard as well. That's the other thing. So all these different cases. It's quite a celebrity heavy episode, although Spacey and Cosby are now more infamous than famous or famous. This being a Saturday episode, it was originally live on the Sean Atwood Show, organized by producer Ash Meikle, so thank you to them for making this one happen. Check out the full episode on the Sean Atwood True Crime podcast. This was part of a 4-hour show, one segment of it that I was hosting. And visit the Black Belt Barrister's YouTube page to see more from him. In addition to being a top barrister, he is also a black belt, hence his online name, in the Korean martial art of Taekwondo, as well as polearm close quarters combat skills. He teaches on a volunteer basis and gives specialist combat courses to the British Army and Special Forces. Pretty cool, hey? Coming up soon are episodes with Elgin Strait, a former Mooney, which is a cult, with information about the assassination of former Japan Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. And the Coffin Confessor is also coming back on to talk about the secrets of the dead. But now you're on the edge of barrister law. Kevin Spacey and Bill Cosby with the Black Belt Barrister. Only go by Black Belt Barrister. You don't see your name as the thing.
On them. I put that on just so it's easier for people to find me. But yeah, my name is Daniel. You can call me Daniel or Dan.
Daniel, I can call you Black Belt Barrister as
you
well.
You can call me Black Belt Barrister if you wish.
Oh, and you sound good. You look good. It's good. We're
hopefully you can hear me. It's not your internet connection that's at fault. I mean, I felt. Really bad for Janice and seeing her cut off like that, but I caught the last bit of it. Sounds like a very moving story, but
you aware of John McAfee?
I'm not actually. I just caught the tail end of the story.
Right. Oh, you got it. There's a documentary called Gringo, which I think was on Netflix or somewhere like that. That was just it's out of this world. He's the most outrageous person I've ever heard of. Just insane.
But I'll check into that.
Tell me about your background and your YouTube channel.
My background, well, my background's in business and martial arts, hence the black belt in the Black Belt Barrister. I was in business before I came to the bar of England and Wales. Some refer to it as the senior half of the profession. You recognize barristers as wearing wigs and gowns, going into court, representing cases, and providing specialist advice is what we do. Early COVID, really, I started the YouTube channel Black Belt Barrister to help people understand law, kind of became my tagline. I'm the barrister that helps you understand law. It's not my first channel. My first channel was in martial arts, helping people understand martial arts, I suppose. It was Black Belt Secrets. So the secrets of martial arts, of being a black belt. So I now tend to offer my opinions on black belt secrets as opposed to black belt barrister. I try to refrain from opinions too much on black belt barrister, more law and understanding legal principles. But hopefully people will subscribe to both, and hopefully you've got both the links. But I hope that I achieve my goals. I get lots of emails telling me that people have won their cases on the back of little tips and guidance, which is always nice to receive. So I really appreciate those. So when people send me those little emails telling me they've had a success from just how we do our job, essentially, and it works for them.
Do you think you're welcome for the advice I gave you for free that you didn't pay for?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's an unbelievably common request to have. I mean, you know, the nice part of me would love to help everyone that ask for help, but there's so many I don't even see them all. I also have to make and earn money, and I make the distinction between the two. You can make money, you can earn money. That's sort of where the business of me comes in, but there we go.
What's the difference?
Making and earn, yeah. So if you're earning money, I think you are exchanging your time for a limited amount of money. To put it bluntly, and I know that might sound harsh, but there is a rate of pay that someone will pay for your time, and they quantify it quite easily. Making money, on the other hand, is you set up systems or you own intellectual property which generates money without your time going into it. That's for me, that's the difference. Yeah,
that's really interesting. Yeah, I never thought
of that. That's like your master's level business course in 30 seconds.
There you go, everyone. We've just all learned something. And just briefly for those non-British people, what's a barrister?
So in England and Wales, I say England and Wales because when I say the UK, I get people in Scotland get upset with me. But in England and Wales, we have a split profession, which is between solicitors and barristers. And although the lines have been blurred somewhat, it is still broadly a separate profession. And I'll describe it as this. So in the United States, you'll have an attorney who will pretty much deal with all of your case for you. And when it goes to trial, they will have what they refer to as a trial lawyer, which is still an attorney, and there's no huge distinction, but just someone who is experienced enough to go and do the trial. In the UK, in England and Wales, we make that distinction between solicitors and barristers. The barrister is the trial lawyer, and the solicitor broadly does everything else. And I'm being very careful not to disrespect anybody, because you can get very, very good solicitors who are far better than very junior barristers. So I'm being diplomatic, but that is the way that it is. One broad distinction is when you qualify and become a practicing barrister, you have automatically full rights of audience up to the Supreme Court, which solicitors do not. Conversely, solicitors can conduct litigation, which is a fancy way of saying filing things in court and filing official documents and receiving official documents. And barristers cannot by default. We have to take an additional extension to our practicing certificate. So I'm one of only around 1,000 barristers in the UK that do that. So I conduct litigation as well. There's a few more distinctions, but that's the broad explanation. So people recognize a barrister, as I say, when you see the wig and gown, which is behind me hanging up there, and the wig is on the stand.
Very cool.
Wig and gowns, that's how you recognize a barrister. Solicitor advocacy gets even more complicated. Say again?
You don't need hair. You can disguise and not having
hair. Absolutely. I can blend right in.
Yeah. Not that I want to assume that you would rather have more hair, nor that Sean would want to have more hair himself. You might both be happy without the hair, but you could disguise with the wig if you wanted.
Interesting. I actually did a video just recently on black belt secrets, because that's where my sort of personal views and opinions come in, about this very issue, because it is still medically described as alopecia. And obviously with the Oscars and Jada Pinkett Smith and all of that, with Will Smith and the slap and so on, some people think it's real, some people think it isn't real. And I'm not going to comment which way or the other, but either way, the issue of alopecia came to the forefront. And what is referred to as male pattern baldness or balding is actually alopecia, only we refer to it differently. And so, you know, whether it's hereditary or in my case, it was sort of, I think it was sort of part hereditary and part a salon burnt my head sort of 15 years ago. And it didn't really grow back after that. So I just cut the rest of it off and made it my style. But I did the video to bring quite, you know, quite frank attention to it, because as you could probably tell, it doesn't bother me. I talk about it openly and I've had jokes about it. I laugh about it. I don't care. It doesn't matter. But for a lot of people, I can absolutely see it's a real problem. Just as a dealing with a legal case and a legal issue. And, you know, I'll put it bluntly, you know, I see everybody is just as susceptible as turning to tears when they go to court. You know, it doesn't matter how big and strong you are, male or female, you could be reduced to tears when you go to court because it's such an overwhelming experience.
Yeah. The baldness thing is that the alopecia, because some people can't take it and, you know, or feel very sensitive about it. I mean, Larry David writes a lot. Do you ever watch Larry David stuff, comedy? He baldness is like a central theme of his comedy, being bald himself.
Yeah, I think I have. Yeah, I think there's one or two that have done that, and I think for a lot of people they will take it on as part of their almost identity, because I think you can do one of two things, and I'm a positivity person. You know, I always look at how do we move forward? How do we move forward positively? What's the objective? What are you trying to achieve? I'm always moving forward. And so I just take it as part of my identity. It's like, oh, well, that's the way it is. Move on, you know, carry on, get on
Screw
with it.
It.
And
yeah. You have to.
And I literally make it part of the identity. And I think if you let it bother you, it holds you back. I think you've got to find a way of moving forward. Like Jada said, you know, she just took to the fact that she cut her hair short and lived with it. And absolutely right. That's the way that I dealt with it. I think the same is true for lots of different things.
Yeah. Oh, fair enough. And let's move from one Hollywood celeb to another. Should we start with Kevin Spacey maybe? And guys in the thingy on the side, if you've got questions, do, you know, ask away and we'll try and get to them and all that. But what's actually, because we all know, I mean, most of us know about allegations going on roughly, but would you be able to summarize what can actually be said about what he is alleged to have done?
Well, I'm not going to go into too many specifics, but it's essentially the charges of assaults of a certain kind. I won't say for your YouTube channel because you're certain words and stuff, but they're a type of assault, man on man, if you will, that are usually taken very seriously. There are two counts in this case, dating back to 2005 and 2008, without consent. And so they are taken fairly seriously. And of course, in the UK, there's no time limit on such things. I know there's statute of limitations in various jurisdictions. In the UK, for such offences, there are no limitations. There's, for summary only offences, there's a fairly strict 6 month time limit. So, you know, one day beyond 6 months and it's out of time. But this could be 30, 40 years old, and it could still be charged. And that's what's happened here. I mean, he's voluntarily appeared, which is worth adding, in the UK for his first appearance. So there's a mix of offences, but because the more serious one goes to the Crown Court, he's going to the Crown Court. So the way it works in England and Wales, I will say, is if there's an offence serious enough to go to the Crown Court, they all go to the Crown Court. If they are linked, which in this case they are, because they're the same kind of nature, so they're all going to the Crown Court. So his first appearance was literally that. It's you turn up, you say I'm here, and you hear what the allegations are. And there's an interesting, I don't know how much your audience is interesting in the trivia, but you'll get it one way or the other, and we'll know in the comments. Let us know in the comments if you like the trivia, because there's tons of it. If you don't like it, I'll stop it. But the trivia is this. Most people will be aware of the notion of credit for pleading guilty and a credit for an early plea. And so the essence of that is the earlier you say, yes, it was me, you get a bigger reduction on any sentence that you would otherwise get. And it starts as a third to a quarter, then it goes all the way down to, well, to nothing when you get to trial. The idea behind that is, one, to save the court time and money, but also to sort of reward the honesty about having committed an offence. Now, the trivia is this. The first opportunity to formally enter a plea is not the first opportunity to indicate that you're likely to plead guilty if you wanted to attract the discount off your sentence. And there's appeal judgments to back this up. So if you're going to formally enter your plea in the Crown Court, as in the case of Kevin Spacey, the magistrate's court appearance would just be to indicate what you're likely to plead. And there is literally a box to check to say intends to plead guilty or not guilty. And in this case, of course, not guilty, and it's going to the Crown Court, at which point he will formally enter, I expect, unless there's a drastic change of heart before then, a not guilty plea. But on the face of it, that's all we know. So he's been charged with these two things, which are both aged from 2005, 2008, and pleaded not guilty. But I think the important bit here, I say it's important because he's voluntarily appeared, there's, by inference, there is no risk that he won't turn up for the next hearing. So he's got unconditional bail, which is relatively rare in cases such as this. And by unconditional bail, it just means there's no conditions attached to it. It's just, you know, go away and come back next time. And ordinarily, it's, you know, there's big objections to bail, which is there's likely to interfere with witnesses, likely to commit further offences, and likely to fail to surrender for the next court appearance. Those are the three big objections. But clearly, there's no glaring objection for the court, so they've granted him unconditional bail. I thought that was interesting, and that's about all we know so far.
Well, that seems almost counterintuitive, because you'd think the average person can't afford really to just go off to the, I mean, is that the fear that he'd go off to the Caribbean and never be heard from again? Whereas he do that. Yeah,
essentially. But because he's come to the UK and voluntarily turned up for the hearing, the argument was, of course, that, well, he turned up, he showed up. So there's no suggestion, there's no evidential basis that he's not going to come back. So that was satisfactory for the court.
From his perspective, why did he turn up in the UK? Couldn't he just stay in the US and go, no? What would happen?
Well, there is the prospect of extradition, and you know, that would take its own path. But I think that the more pressing, apart from the pragmatic, but the more pressing issue is that this would then forever hang over him, would it not? Because if he's been charged with it here but doesn't turn up to face those charges, it would forever hang over him as something that he was accused of doing and never cleared his name for. So I strongly suspect, and this is not quite venturing into opinion territory just yet, but I strongly suspect that he wants to clear his name. And that's why he's volunteering to the proceedings, because I think that to surrender to them is certainly indicative of cooperating with the proceedings, and ultimately to face those charges and clear his name or not, as the case might be.
Hey, it's Andrew. If you're enjoying Heretics, there's another podcast I want to recommend to you, especially if climate change, global conflicts, and an upcoming election are making you feel like we're on the brink of disaster. What Could Go Right is hosted by Progress Network founder Zachary Carabel and executive director Emma Varvalukas. On What Could Go Right, the hosts sit down with expert guests to discuss the world's most pressing issues without resorting to pessimism or despair that we hear so often. Instead, they look back at how far society has come and look forward at what it will take to achieve an even brighter future. Is progress on the way? They may not have all the answers, but on what could go right, they're asking the key questions. Tune in to hear interviews with upcoming guests like writer Coleman Hughes, CNN host Fareed Zakaria, and economist Alison Schrager. If you're looking for a weekly dose of optimistic ideas from smart people, join them every Wednesday on What Could Go Right, available wherever you get your podcasts.
I suppose this is a problem maybe with media reporting or due process, but it hadn't even entered my mind that he might be able to clear his name or that he might not have done these things. And I bet I'm speaking on behalf of most people. Is that a problem? Do you think that's a problem that people like me, it's not even entered our minds?
You mean in the sense that you've read it, therefore it,
yeah,
you feel that it seems to be true, therefore. I think it's because of that. I mean, with great respect to you, I think it's because of that that he needs to do this,
yeah,
to clear his name. Because I'm not going to mention any names from history, but if I were to mention certain names from history, certain things come to your mind because of what they've been accused of doing. And I think because of that, you sort of absolutely have to face them and clear your name, so that otherwise, if you don't do that, you can never, or they can never say that they were cleared of it. But to answer your question properly, it's only a problem in so much as the public perception. And when it comes to a jury trial, which this obviously will be, I have faith in the jury system. And I know there are criticisms of the jury system. People say that, you know, they're unqualified and so on and so forth. But there is also this imperfection in the system, even if you follow the letter of the law and the letter of the procedure. Because, and I'll give you an example. So take it as read that you have an absolute slam dunk case, but there's one golden bit of evidence that you just don't produce in court because you don't think it's relevant. Or conversely, there's another bit of evidence that you think is fine, but actually it's damaging to your case, even though it gives the wrong impression. And so the result is you lose, even though, as I said, take it as read that you had an absolute slam dunk case. That's not, well, in one sense or another, that's not proper justice, is it? Because you think, well, you were right. So, you know, in this scenario, we are assuming you are right. 100%, no question, you are right. But the system and the way the system works meant that you lost the case. And that's the system and the procedure and the evidence and all the rest of it. So that's the system. Then when you've got a punishable offense, particularly a serious one, we call upon the jury to fill in those gaps and say, well, this is what they say happened. This is what we say as defense. Mm-hmm. What do you think? And we leave that to a jury, because we like the jury to be unanimous. And it's only with the judges say so that they can reduce it to, you know, a majority, which is rare in itself. I see someone in the comments saying common law. Yes, in a sense. Now, there's a broad discussion on common law, which a lot of people misunderstand common law. A lot of people think common law and the system and statutes and legislation are different things, and that's not quite true. Common law is the collective decisions of judges interpreting and applying the law to new cases, which may be compounding old common law onto new cases. So like, you know, murder, for example, is still a common law offense, but it was decided within a case itself in court. Obviously, it's been updated since then. There's various other types of, homicide and so on, captured within legislation. But new cases decided form new common law, but they work together as a body of law with legislation. So I was just picking up on one of the comments there. That was all. Because a lot of people do draw the distinction between court cases and process and legislation and think they're different. So
right. Well, I'm interested actually in the chat and what people do think, because in terms of, you know, with a jury coming up, of course, and that is one of the criticisms, that there could be some bias because of the media. I mean, how many people, I reckon, put a one if you Put a one if you're just sure that Kevin Spacey did do these crimes, and put a two if you're open to the idea that maybe he didn't. I'm just interested in how that goes, because I just think most of us are just convinced, and I just feel like I'm going to ask you as well. Just going back to the crimes you talked about, without consent. Now, does that mean that he was forceful with somebody? Or does that mean that it was somebody who was too young to give their consent?
Well, it could be either. And it doesn't necessarily mean with force either. Because, you know, if let's say I'm sat next to you right now and I use your mobile phone without your consent, there's no force involved in that. And let's say you're too shy to tell me to stop and I just use your phone. I'm using your phone without consent, so there's not necessarily any force involved, if people can follow the analogy. It just means that, but you're right, yes, either consent wasn't freely given or was not of capacity to provide that. And different don't Google this, anybody, but different jurisdictions have different ages for such things, but don't Google it. You'll end up on a list. yes, it could mean a lot of different things, but the one thing I will say, and again, I'm not venturing into opinion and giving my opinion either way on Kevin Spacey here, but what I would say to those that are absolutely sure that he did this, what I would say to you is you don't know, because you haven't seen the evidence. And you cannot know for sure. The only way you would know for sure, if you heard all the evidence presented and then all the defense to rebut that evidence and then come to a decision. And that's why we trust the jury. That's right, the only way you can be sure.
I've got two parts of my head now. I've got one of them's going like, what you've just said is the right thing. And then the other, the more emotional side is going, yeah, but he did it.
It must be true. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. And everybody, and that's the point. And I've described it a number of ways in the past. And the best way that I come to is this. When you watch, or when you hear rather, when you hear the prosecution case, which is both the opening and the evidence of each of the witnesses that they call and any other evidence that they bring, CCTV and so on and so forth. When you hear the whole of the prosecution case, you should be absolutely convinced they are right. This happened. And then you think, don't need to hear anymore. You should be convinced. In a good case, in a case that should have been brought, you should be convinced. However, then you hear the defense case, and they cross-examine the witnesses and they challenge the evidence and they put doubts in your mind and they robustly defend it. You should then be equally convinced that there's no way that this happened. Yeah. And so there's no way this is true. This just didn't happen. And then you go back to the jury room and you should be left in the position of thinking, what on earth do we think now? Because you should have, both clearly and fiercely fought positions that you then have to fill in the blanks, and that's when you know you've got a fair trial. And so one of the things go ahead.
Oh no, I want to hear what you want to say.
I was just going to follow that up with one thing we often say to clients is, when you hear the evidence against you, whether it's civil or criminal, people get just as upset about civil trials as they do criminal trials, more so in some cases. We say, you'll be really upset when you hear the case against you. So be prepared for that. Mm. People think they won't, but we say, be prepared to be upset when you hear the case against you. But remember, you've got your turn afterwards.
Yeah, no, of course. And if Kevin Spacey, what could happen to him? Is it a worse crime because it's an underage person? I guess it's speculation, but what could happen if he's found guilty?
If it were as serious as that and that's found to be the case, and let's say it all goes against him, then it could be a significant sentence. It could be a significant custodial sentence, and a sentence can only be suspended, meaning they don't go directly to prison, if it's under 2 years and it's suspended for up to 2 years. And so that they don't go to prison immediately, you know, unless they commit a further offence, in which case they usually go to prison for the original one and the new one. But this would likely, if all of that were borne out and he was found guilty, then he'd likely be significantly north of 2 years, so it wouldn't be suspended. So there wouldn't be an option, really, of sending him to prison. But as I say, you know, I think a lot of people do jump to the conclusion. I'm going to go on a very slight cliff edge and say I think a lot of people jump to conclusions because of the nature of the offence, and they think, well, this is so bad, therefore, you know, they can't possibly accuse someone of that unless it really happened. But for those that are sure, let me tell you this. Obviously, I can't give any. And I would never give any specific details, but I've been involved in lots of family cases where equally grotesque accusations are made falsely, and they are just not true. So these accusations are made, and there's no merit behind them whatsoever. So for those of you that are sure, I'm telling you, you can't be sure. You really can't.
I guess it's the number of people as well, isn't it? The accusers. I think there was sort of one initial person, then there were 15 others came out, and then three men in the UK have come out. But I suppose you could say they're jumping on, it's possible they could be jumping on some sort of bandwagon.
Potentially, yeah. I mean, as I say, I mean, I'm not exactly, you know, jumping up as defense advocate here. I'm remaining neutral. But what I am saying is, you know, there will be a case against him. There will be a case in defense. There always is. But until that determination, no one can be sure. And you can say, you know, you could take that with the Depp Heard trial. You know, a lot of people were so sure. A lot of people were so sure because of the UK verdict, but then obviously completely overturned their views because of the VA verdict. So, you know,
You know what? I want to get to that, but I want to get to Bill Cosby first, because it's another name that we've not spoken about so much on this channel. Obviously, we've done quite a bit of Heard and Depp, although I do want to get onto that. Again, what is the latest with Bill Cosby? Because I sort of read his Wikipedia, and it's quite confusing to me about what seems to be going on. So in layman's terms, what's going on?
So again, sort of limiting the language for YouTube so as not to limit your video, but in essence, this goes back to 1975, with a 16-year-old at the time, and that lady who, when made the allegation and the case came to trial, was 64 years old. So you can see the difference in the time frame there. And there was a bit of a legal technicality as to why the limitations were overridden, because again, in the UK, there is no limitation for such things, but in the US, there normally is, but that was overridden on technical legal grounds. And ultimately, this was a civil trial, not a criminal trial, but because there's a parallel between, there's almost always a parallel between civil and criminal allegations and cases. So just on a brief tangent, so people follow that, because it's relevant to this trial. The best explanation is someone damages your car. So it's criminal because it's criminal damage, but there's a civil claim because you've got to repair the car. So there's a monetary value to repair the car, but it's criminal if it's criminal damage. Interestingly enough, you can't criminally damage your own property. So if you smash your own phone up, it's not criminal. So in this case, and it's probably also useful to explain that a civil trial is normally there to just provide damages, which means money to compensate or to rectify the wrong, if you like. And in the States, you have punitive damages as well for certain things like defamation, where someone has done something with malice, which doesn't quite mean what everyone thinks it does, but we'll get back to that. But in such cases where someone has done something deliberately wrong like that, there are punitive damages, and the punitive bit is designed to punish the person. So there's compensatories to obviously compensate the person. Punitive is to punish the person. But ultimately, all civil damages are designed to provide a compensation of some form. And so in this case, as I understand it, there's a £500,000 award for this particular aged offence, which again just goes to prove that these things can come back many years later. I mean, of course, this was on top of there were three counts of assault some years ago, but they were overturned. And this again, I mean, this comes to a point. A lot of people are not necessarily convinced when it's overturned on a technicality. So, you know, let's say someone accused of a crime gets the conviction overturned on a real technicality of the let's say the evidence and the chain of custody or something, like, because it's a common one. If there's a break in the chain of custody, then they go to the Court of Appeal and they say there's no way you can prove this was the same thing. And it most likely was, but that's not beyond any reasonable doubt, is it? So but that's what happened to him some years ago. But obviously this is the latter one of those. So ultimately he's found guilty of that.
And did he have to pay then $500,000?
Yes, as I understand it, it's $500,000dollar compensation. Which
and then prison as well, or it's just because money? What's money to him? I have no idea, but he could have millions.
Well, I presume so, and that's what a lot of people find difficult to accept, because a lot of people say it's just money. Well, that's all the civil courts can impose. If you want the criminal trial, then, you know, in the States, you've got this certain limitations, and B is a different standard of proof. So I would reasonably suspect that if it were a full blown criminal trial, in any sense, in any case, there's going to be a far more difficult burden to overcome than a civil trial because of the burden of proof. So, and again, there's a trivia for you. Do tell me in the comments if I'm boring you with the legal trivia, but there's an interesting legal trivia here. But if someone is tried in the criminal courts in England and Wales and found not guilty, you can still go to the civil court and assert that they were guilty. And so, again, taking the car scenario, let's say someone scratched your car. Let's say they were found not guilty of criminal damage to your car, but you're really annoyed about it. And so you sue them in the civil courts for the money to repair your car. You can say to the court, you know, Your Honor, on the balance of probabilities, this defendant did commit this offense and did damage my car. And you can use the fact that they were tried in the criminal courts as part of your evidence, and say that, you know, the Crown felt that there was a case against them, and they wouldn't have done so unless it felt that there was sufficient evidence to bring about a conviction, and therefore on the balance of probabilities they did do it, therefore I want my money. So it's an interesting trivia that there's this overlap between civil and criminal.
So I read that in 2005 in the civil court, you know, he admitted that he was using Quaaludes drugs on women, which is a horrific crime. It must be. So why has he not been prosecuted in criminal court?
I can't answer that. I don't have an answer for that. It must only be that either time limits or inadmissibility of what they say was a confession, and how the confession came about. There's lots of technicalities. I'd have to read into that to give you a proper answer.
Because it's particularly of all these crimes, and you don't want to create a hierarchy of crimes or anything like that, but it's particularly egregious what he's alleged to have done, you know, especially when he was like that family face, wasn't he? Bill Cosby. I grew up watching all that stuff. And
America's nice dad, as he was known, yeah.
Yeah, it was very much the Jimmy Savile of the US in that sense, I suppose.
Yeah. I agree with you. But then when you get the notion that it's particularly egregious, then the more severe it is, the higher the burden of proof. So again, when it came about with because a confession can be is hearsay. So it depends how the confession came about as well. Because if hearsay is, again, legal trivia, but hearsay is anything that is not said in oral evidence, which is truth of the matter stated. So I could write down on a piece of paper, I damaged the car. And if you bring it as evidence, it's hearsay because you're trying to prove the truth that I damaged the car. If I get to court and say, no, I didn't. And you say, yeah, well, yeah, you did, because you wrote down on this piece of paper that you damaged the car. And I say, no, I didn't. That's hearsay. That doesn't prove that I did it. It's only proof that I wrote that down. And then, you know, some people will, well, surely you did it because you wrote it down. But I can tell you again, you can't be sure, because I've been in situations like this before now. And long story short, the reason the guy said it or wrote it was because somebody said they were going to kill his wife and children if he didn't. So you can't be sure. And suddenly,
is that why? Presumably, I could talk. I imagine about something like, I could say, "Oh, talk about drug use or something that I did 10 years ago or whatever." But I'd never really get, you know, prosecuted for it, because I'd just be like, "No, I just said that."
Yeah, essentially, yeah. Because if you don't say in court, and the only way that they know that you did it is because someone else heard you say it, or, you know, they could give your, they, this is where these aged allegations come into court, where someone comes forward and says, this happened, and they become a witness. Now, if it's one person, it's what we call word against word. It's just one person against another. And there's almost always a reasonable doubt that they're just lying. But when you've got something else, and, you know, as you say, many more people coming forward, only if their accounts sort of stack up and corroborate, then potentially it can work. But aged allegations are notoriously difficult to prove, particularly to the criminal standard, which is technically beyond a reasonable doubt, but it's now described as being so that the jury are sure that it happened, just to help the jury understand what it really means. You've got to be sure, not just nearly sure, not just, well, more likely, and, you know, that sort of thing. It's got to be absolutely sure, no doubt.
Yeah. So we found ourselves in a situation where a very powerful man has been raping the women with drugs and force and different kinds, you know, for years, and it's just free to walk the streets. Allegedly, it's all allegedly, I guess.
Essentially, yeah. I mean, that's the allegation, and you know, I've no doubt that's not the only instance. There's probably, sadly, a great many cases like that, and so they go unheard, and it's this whole principle of being unheard that has made certain recent trials so popular to talk about, because suddenly everyone's talking about it. And I certainly know a lot of people message me and say that they watch because this happened to them, or they've been accused. And I've had lots of emails that people's lives been turned upside down for 2 or 3 years whilst they're accused of something, only for it all to fall away at the end. And, you know, sorry about that, but it's 2 or 3 years of their life. I mean, the average, RAPE case that goes through the courts of England and Wales takes up to 4 years to come to trial. And imagine that, having, you know, the complainant slash victim waiting around for 4 years to bring that to court, to give evidence, to only to relive it all over again. It's horrendous.
Yeah.
People do make false allegations, but by and large, when there's enough evidence to bring the case, it's difficult to the conviction rate is it's not below 50%, put it that way. They think carefully before they bring a case.
Yeah, that's interesting. A conviction rate. How did Cosby get out of prison? Asks Keza 91. So he was in prison, Cosby.
Yeah, I don't know, actually. I have to look into that one.
I'm just looking now.
I think there was a technicality. There was he overturned the verdict because it was obviously the old one. It will come to me in a minute.
Yeah, some sort of technicality. His lawyer said, "We knew all along he shouldn't have been prosecuted for this." Cosby tweeted, "I have never changed my stance nor my story. I've always maintained my innocence." I'm not having that. I'm not having it. He was initially convicted of drugging and sexually assaulting accuser. Well, I won't say her name because maybe she doesn't want to be. Yeah, I guess it was some sort of technicality. It was done. I read it before and I didn't really understand. It was all just, it was mad to me. It was all like,
yeah. I do remember reading it and now I can't remember what it was. It was a technicality from what I remember. But as I say, it will come to me in a minute.
That's outrageous, isn't it? Do you think they go easier on, you know, because he is in his mid-80s. He's got problems apparently with memory and recollection. Do you think they go a little easier sometimes? Or they think, oh, we don't need to prosecute this person properly or something?
Well, they certainly shouldn't. That shouldn't bear any real any change on the way they approach the case at all. It should just be a case for what it is. The only time that would make a difference is if they were not competent to give evidence or to face the trial or when they're being sentenced, it might make a difference as a mitigating factor for sentence, but certainly not with the approach to the case.
Right. Yeah. I just wondered about that. Because it is hard not to think about that, I suppose. Someone's really old, you're going, oh, just, yeah. You know, what's he going to do now? You know? I can see you're looking. You're reading.
Yeah, I'm reading sort of very quickly what this was.
A lot of pressure. A lot of pressure.
Yeah. So I'm reading here from Sky News, which I normally trust. His lawyers argued during the appeal hearing that the Montgomery County District Attorney should not have charged him in 2015 because he held the previous DA job, decided not to file criminal charges in the case and issued a press release announcing the decision. Previous refusal to prosecute meant he couldn't avoid testifying. I think it was a confusion over making a statement that they weren't going to do something, then did it anyway. And so there was an overturn because of that, from what I can read. Yeah, it's a technicality.
Oh, it's mad. That part of law, I get it. I get why that exists, but it's pretty mad. We've got some time left. I want to move on to Amber Heard and Johnny Depp. What actually happened in the end? Because we were so on it. Everyone was like obsessed with it. And then once sort of the results came out, so to speak, it was sort of, I think people weren't even properly reading it. It was just like, well, she seems terrible, is what I think most people were saying. What actually happened?
So, I mean, in a nutshell, the jury didn't believe a word she said. That's probably the simplest way of putting it. Every lawyer I've spoken to said she was just completely not credible. Her evidence didn't stack up. There are too many inconsistencies, too many contradictions, even down to the... as lawyers, we don't like to lean too much on body language because we prefer evidence. We prefer to look at evidence. So therefore, I lean on the behavior panel because I would never fault them with their, you know, so many decades of experience in resistance to interrogation and body language experts, world renowned. If you don't know them, go check them out. They all stake their reputation that she's being deceitful. And so I'd stake mine on trusting theirs because I work with people like them in the UK, ex-special forces and so on, and I trust what they say. I trust their judgments. And so even from the body language aspect, she was being deceitful. But from the evidential point of view, there's so many inconsistencies. There's so many contradictions. If I were to say to you that I injured my left knee, I would point to my left knee while I'm talking about the injury, which is true. I injured it the other week. One example was when she was talking about the phone and she gestured to, I think it was this side of the face when it was this side that was injured, for example. And There's so many different contradictions in the evidence, and the jury just didn't believe it. And again, this is why I say we trust juries, because they fill in the blanks. They hear both sides, because they are independent, and they hear both sides of the arguments, and then they make a decision. They decide who they think was more credible. A large part of it, I think, was because she didn't take any accountability for anything she did, whereas Johnny Depp said, I did get drunk, I did smash up the furniture, but I didn't do that. Whereas she wouldn't take any.
I'm really skeptical of all the behavior stuff, and also I'm just saying it to be devil's advocate, because I know they are really popular, the behavior panel. I know Eric Hunley comes on here and talks about that stuff as well, but the behavior panel on here as well. But I mean the Amanda Knox case, and I know everyone's going to shout at me in the thing, and you can, I don't mind everyone shouting at me, but I don't think she did that. And I think the behavior, she did behave like she did, but I don't think she did it. Do you know what I mean? And isn't that where we can go a bit wrong with that stuff?
It can, and this is why I think we look for patterns, and it's the same with evidence. So I use the analogy with evidence as they do with behavior, because I wouldn't profess to be a behavior expert, although I know when someone's lying, put it that way. But I wouldn't hold myself out as a behavior expert. I would hold myself out as being an expert looking at the evidence, of course. So the analogy is not just when you see it once. You know, if someone looks down when they say something, it doesn't mean they're lying to you. Whereas looking down is associated with dishonesty. But it's like playing poker when you've got a tell, when there's a certain pattern that somebody does every time that they are... on their baseline, as they call it, their normal response to something. And then when they only deviate with certain types of questions, and they deviate in ways that they expect to associate with dishonesty, and there's a whole pattern of them, a cluster of them happening together, they come to the conclusion. And it's the same with evidence. It's like if you just happen to mix up a few dates, but it's obvious that you're just not a date person. You get dates wrong all the time, like I do. I'm hopeless at remembering birthdays, but page numbers I'm great with. And paragraph numbers, you know, I can literally tell you, you know, like, you know, paragraph 576 of the lower court judgment and what, you know, bits of what it says and stuff like this. Whereas, you know, there's a pattern of behavior, there's a pattern of evidence. And when people present with that, pattern of inconsistency and things like that, it just stands out, and it becomes really clear. So when you've seen it so many times, you just know, because the pattern is there, the pattern's established. And that's why I trust the behavior panel. It's not because they say, well, aha, there's a textbook that says when they do this, this, and this, they're lying. It's not as simple as that. It's a whole cluster and decades of experience. Mm-hmm. And so the same is when we look at evidence and patterns of evidence and patterns of inconsistency, damage to credibility, and we look at all those as a round collectively, we can say their story doesn't add up. Story doesn't add up because, they probably had, you know, half a dozen or a dozen photos in this trial, some of which were repeats and have been proven to be repeats or edited and so on. I injured my knee because I tripped over something that was negligently left there. I've probably got nearly 100 photographs of my knee healing because it was quite a horrific injury. Probably nearly 100 photos just over 6 weeks or so. And that's only because I'm suing them. You know, because I shouldn't have been there. If this was something so, so serious, and I've been in cases where people have genuinely had their head caved in by their partner, and there's, you know, blood everywhere and so on, and, you know, we have to look through that evidence, there's a lot more. To someone like me who's doing these cases, this was not a credible story. It just, the odd bruise here and there, it doesn't stack up. It really doesn't stack up.
Photos.
Yeah, it just lack of everything. I mean, she, when you think of what she did to take photographs of, she took photographs of the floor, she took photographs of the table, she took photographs of the mirror, and but not much else. And she recorded him smashing up the you know, cabinets. Well, I wouldn't say smashing up, hitting the cabinets, break, you know, throwing a bottle, but nothing else. And so, you know, I've been in cases where one party has given a, you know, a firm account of what's happened, but then my clients produced an audio recording an hour and a half long showing everything that happened that evening, and it's completely not, it's completely the reverse. And the, you know, the point is that people can produce this evidence when they want to. And I know it's an argument, Elaine made the argument, you know, what do we do now when people don't, you know, if you don't have evidence, then, you know, no one's going to believe you. Well, no, that's not necessarily it, but you might not have the photographic evidence, but, you know, you will tell somebody, or someone will see it. And even if they don't see it because you're hiding at home, someone will notice that you're missing. They'll come looking for you, or they'll note that you didn't come into work, or you avoided, you know, you avoided your friends. There's a whole pattern that follows, and police reports. So another case, I mean, this is just, these are just, I've got so many examples, but another example was my client's partner said that she had severe brain injuries because he was assaulting her. And, you know, she was receiving treatment from the hospital and so on and so forth. There was no medical evidence whatsoever. She'd never been scanned. There was no documentary evidence. There was no visit reports, nothing. And so we got to court and we just said, well, there is no evidence of this. Nothing.
Yeah.
No photographs of injuries, no medical reports, no doctor's notes, absolutely nothing. And so obviously not proven. Because
it teaches you, doesn't it? If something happens, you take loads of photos of your knee. Mm. I've got a good little comment here from Jackie Traylor saying, Amanda Knox definitely had something to do with it. I was very close to Meredith's family. I know them well, Meredith being the English victim. I grew up with her sister, Stephanie. That's quite remarkable, really. And thank you for the comment. I got quite friendly with Amanda myself, and she just seems so nice and smiley and lovely. I know that's not proof of anything, but she hasn't exactly re-offended. So I don't know.
Well, there is that human element to it when you can, you can sometimes judge someone by their character alone, but when you want to make a serious decision on something, you do have to look at everything in the round. And so you've either got evidence to support something or you don't. And so not having the evidence is almost evidence itself.
Yeah. I mean, it was just such a complicated one, that whole... Mm. Did you watch the Amanda Knox Netflix documentary?
I didn't, I don't think.
Oh, it's good. It's good because it gets you believing she did it, and then halfway through it starts to unravel, and you're like, "Oh no, they've taken her for she didn't. She wasn't involved in this at all." So yeah. Annie says, "I absolutely believe her." And there you go. So it's like 50-50, really.
Crazy. Yeah, and that's a good way of putting it with the civil versus criminal, because a civil trial is literally 50-50 and tip the balance. 51% goes in one direction than the other. So it's literally more likely than not. Whereas criminal, there's no percentages. I mean, there's no percentage at all, but civil is more likely than not. But the more serious, the higher that should go. But criminal is, you've got to be sure. Because if we're going to punish somebody for it, you've got to be sure about it.
Yeah, she spent 4 years in prison.
Yeah. Crazy. And so if you get someone out of prison after years and then say, oops, sorry about that. Well, no, sorry, you've taken out, you know, 4% of your life if you live to 100, you know, so.
Yeah. Oh, horrible that.
Yeah,
really,
it is.
Really bad. But it was just, I mean, the DNA was inconsequential. It was just not enough, shouldn't have been, you know, charged in the first place, or at least not convicted. But going back to Amanda Heard and Johnny Depp and all that. So I saw her recently, just straight after the defamation case, literally just finished. And then she went in a magazine interview and said exactly the same stuff again. Do you see that? Like, what's going to happen now?
Yeah, I saw it. So there's what could happen and what will or won't happen. So what could happen, defamation claims for what we call republication, which is essentially saying what you said previously, which is now found to be defamatory, or new or fresh publications if they are found to be, they go further, they go beyond what was originally said. And I think if she does go with this book that's been touted, I think that might well go beyond, and there may well be fresh defamation. But then what will or will not happen, it depends how far it goes. I think JD's probably feels like he's done enough to clear his name. So he's probably, you know, he's not going to convince everybody, obviously, but I think he feels like he's convinced enough people that that's it now, you know, move on. But it depends how far this, if there is a book, how far the book goes. And if if it goes to, because I can only imagine there's a lot more that didn't come into this trial, because there's, you never get everything in a trial.
Yeah.
So if there's a significant amount more, then there could well be, you know, more defamation claims, even if she pseudonymizes him again, because she didn't mention him in the op-ed, but everybody knew who she was referring to. And the odd thing that I referred to as the truth within the truth, like one of her tells of telling the truth, oddly enough, was when she looked, I'd say the most genuine, when she sort of just smiles and answers a question, she looks the most genuine. And when she says this wasn't about him, now the point here is this: it possibly wasn't about him because it didn't happen, so say the jury, but she was using the idea that it was him to lend her voice, as she put it, to this movement. So I did a video on that, which you'll find on my channel, the truth within the truth. You know, was this the truth from her? The real truth within what she's saying the truth is.
Right.
But the point was, it didn't really matter, because anyone reading it, because the way defamation works is, if you reasonably infer the meaning from the article, then it doesn't matter whether you're wrong. You know, so everyone knew it was about him, or at least they reasonably believed it was, and therefore it was defamatory. It met the threshold. So I thought that's quite quirky.
The year is 2030, and we're having another conversation about the fifth court proceeding between them. Presumably that can never sort of cross over, something like defamation, into criminal proceedings, right? It can't be like she's done it. Every time she gets out, she does it again and says he's a wife beater or whatever, and then goes to prison or something. Or is it just always going to be monetary stuff?
Well, I think that there are some parallel sort of harassment and malicious communication type offences in the States. We certainly have them here. We've got the new offences of coercive control and stalking and various things that have come into the Protection from Harassment Act 1997, which are malicious communications. And so if you're communicating something with the sole intent or being reckless as to some, you know, causing someone else alarm and distress and so on, then that could be, could become an offense depending on how many times you do it. It's like if I wrote on Twitter once, you know, I don't like you, you know, well, who cares? It doesn't matter, does it? But if I did that every single day from a new account, and, you know, that would get pretty tiring, and that would be quite malicious. And so that becomes an offense. So they can cross over into criminal territory.
Thank you very much to the Black Belt Barrister for coming on the show. Give him some love, everyone, by subscribing to his YouTube channel, which is The Black Belt Barrister. Thanks also to Sean Atwood for letting me put this out here. The interview was part of the Sean Atwood True Crime Podcast and the Atwood Unleashed show on YouTube. Thanks producer Ash Meikle as well for arranging it. That's all for now. Please keep sharing this podcast with friends so it can grow and flourish. And do review on Apple Podcasts. Coming up are episodes about the Moonies and the assassinated former Prime Minister of Japan, and the Coffin Confessor coming back on the show and revealing the secrets of the dead. That's what he does. He goes to funerals. He's paid by the dying person to reveal their secrets. So I'll see you then. It's a great week ahead.